This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says? No, he's not a friend of mine.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Yeah, here we go, another Brock and Salk podcast. You know, I've heard that open I don't know how many times. And I'm not going to talk just about the Mora thing. I know I've done that a few times. But it just dawns on me in listening to it this time. So you've got Al Michaels talking about Brock, right? You've got Jim Mora talking about Brock.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got big voice guy
and
mentioning
then I think
Brock.
You got big voice guy kind of says who's on the show. And then the only other sound in there, because it is Brock and Salk, right? The second part of the show. Is We Just Stink Man from Bruce Drennan supposed to be directed at me?
You love Bruce Drennan.
I'm not saying I don't, but it's interesting that you've got Brock, and then Bruce, Drennan saying, ah, we just stink, man. So what was the, is that really, was this a subtle shot that it's taken me a year and a half, 2 years to get?
If it was a subtle shot, would it take a year and a half? I mean, that
yes,
would be
it might.
Next
Very
level
subtle.
Subtlety.
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
Is that where, who created this open? Kyle, was it you?
Wasn't me.
Brock,
no.
Were you involved in this?
Uh-uh.
I know
uh-uh.
I didn't do it. Did we shop that out to somebody?
It's not my voice.
No, but...
I didn't make the music.
So how could I be to blame? I didn't write the script.
Uh-huh.
I didn't find the sound bites.
Uh-huh. Well, wait. Who found the sound bites?
Sources say.
Sources, yes.
I mean...
And
know,
who knows?
Who really did? Was it? Wasn't it?
Right.
Nobody knows?
Nobody knows. Nobody even knows?
Is that Bruce Drennan or Salk at the end? Because I hear... A Brock, big voice guy, Salk.
Right.
That's not...
We just stink, man.
And I used to have you, saying, next you're going to call me Katarina Vitt. And, you used to have some of your wonderful...
Used to.
Comps to women's figure skating
yeah.
and all that. Yeah.
Alberto Tomba, maybe?
Sure.
He dated Katarina Vitt, for God's sakes.
Who could
Tomba,
forget?
Tomba La Bomba?
Before there was Bennifer, there was...
Tomba La Bomba
Tomba La Bomba.
Katarina Vitt.
Yeah.
Well, it is almost Winter Olympics time. Maybe it's time to bring out... I read a story the other day about Peekaboo Street.
Oh, hello. Wow.
Yeah, I was getting myself ready for the
Bodie
Olympics.
Miller talk.
Yeah, I was reading about Peekaboo Street and some of the issues she's had with her family. And oh, yeah.
Mm. I spent parts of eighth grade in a felt soul patch
yeah.
In the name of Apollo Anton Ono.
Wow.
As I'm sure Brock and Howdy or
didn't he come in, Brock? Didn't we have him on? Apollo Ono? We had someone like that on. Didn't we have a...
J.R. Selsky? So. He was kind of the next generation.
I think you had Apollo.
I think we had Apollo Ono in studio with us.
I think we did.
In this room, the old room.
Like, yes.
I think
from
he sat right in that corner.
I think
from here.
We had Apollo Ono in studio with us. I'm confident of it.
Awesome.
I think.
Memory.
I think I'm confident in it. Howdy, were you imitating Richard Sherman over there? He had quite a week.
Wow, how about that?
Nobody knows.
So, Sherm, in all of the years we've been talking, how much time do you think we've devoted over the years to Richard Sherman?
Whew.
Like,
Russell 1, Sherm 2?
Pete. Mm. Pete 2.
Marshawn Sherm?
Yeah, maybe Sherm Marshawn. It would be neck and neck, right, between
mm-hmm.
those two guys. A lot on Earl, a lot on Cam, obviously. Some of the big star, Doug Baldwin certainly has taken up a lot of time and energy, etc. But over the years, Sherm's right up there.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And in almost all of those conversations, once he sort of, had his heel turn at some point, all of those conversations were generally met with, how dare you? You guys are fanning the flames. You guys are jerks. Richard's the best. This is why the media is the worst. Yada, yada. Right. And that's fine. Like, that's totally okay. This was the first time I've ever written anything about Sherman, talked about Sherman, etc. And we go back and play some of the sound if you want, where I felt like people were like really mad at him.
Yeah.
And it's the first time that all of his vitriol, rather than being, or his irritation, whatever word you want to put on it, rather than being directed at Russell, directed at Pete, directed at the Seahawks organization, or directed at members of the media, his ire, maybe that's the best word, was directed at you, the fans.
I think at the end of the day, and Seattle fans are going to hate to hear this because it's just, they hate to accountability these days, but they're probably going to get rid of Bobby. And once you do that, that's it. That's
downhill.
It. That's
yeah.
it. That's it. You're in rebuild. I don't care if Russell's there or not there. You're in rebuild mode. Bobby Wagner is not there.
So maybe some of that still directed at Russ, right? I don't care for Russ to say. I don't care if you have a quarterback. If you don't have the middle linebacker who's past his prime, well, forget it. You're in a rebuild.
Also seen him throw four picks in a game.
Right. One's our
Okay,
that.
Yeah, all right. The game you won in the NFC title game.
So there was that, and then the follow-up where he calls them these fans. That one was, I thought, like, whoa, these fans?
Did he just say their fans hate accountability?
He did, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Like fanatics have to have and be held accountable?
No. No.
I mean, in his mind, do fans have to be accountable?
Like, maybe. Yes.
Oh, of course.
God. Yes. Of Why course aren't the fans do. Held accountable for what they want? The fans wanted to get rid of this person and it didn't work. Where's the accountability for them? Who's going to fire the fans?
Play that for me again, Howdy. Let me just, I want to hear that, make sure I hear that correct. I think that's what he said.
I think at the end of the day, you know, and Seattle fans are going to hate to hear this because it's just, they hate to accountability.
See, it's funny that you say it that way. I took it much more as the fans don't want other people held accountable.
Yes.
But Brock, your view might be just as accurate. Why isn't somebody holding these fans accountable for their stupid opinion?
Oh, that's how I totally took it. If there was accountability, then that would be holding Bobby Wagner accountable for his poor play.
Maybe that's why I was so confused by what he was saying, because I took it in a different direction. Who's holding these fans accountable for their stupid
takes? Well,
because
he goes on to say, well, and everyone thought it would be a good idea to get rid of us, and now they knew they're wrong, so they don't want to be held accountable for their wrong opinions.
But you can't appreciate that, because now people are saying, let's get rid of Bobby. He costs too much money. So there is no guarantee you're going to keep them. There's no guarantee Bobby stays. And when people start to talk like that, and then you get what you wanted, because they were talking about get rid of us. And they were like, we got replacements. We got LOB 2.0. And then you got rid of us. And then you realize you don't.
Now he sounds like he's talking about the media, not the fans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
You think he's just talking about the fans?
Yes.
Well, he's wrong. The fans didn't want to get rid of anybody. The fans wanted to keep... They want to drag out like a decrepit Earl Thomas in 30 years and see if he can still cover sideline to sideline. What is he talking about? That's not the fans' point
nope.
of view.
Mm-mm.
I got to tell you, this is the first time people have ever, I've heard anyway, been like, yeah, Sherm's nuts. What is he talking about?
Yeah.
Like, what in the world is he even saying?
What is remarkable is Sherm wants accountability for Pete. Sherm wants accountability for Russ.
For
Sherm
sure.
wants accountability for the media. Go-to guy. Sherm wants accountability now for the fans. Sherm wants accountability for everybody but?
Sherm.
Sure.
Yes. I mean, it's true. It's once you've gone to that level with the fans, I mean... Who's left?
About?
Who's left?
That's like, honestly, it's like asking for accountability for your dog. Like, oh, well, so my kid did this and that wasn't, but the dog does it and it's fine? Like, yeah, it's a dog.
Oh, yeah, and he just pees in the yard. Yeah, he just gets away with it. Nobody cares. Are you going to hold this dog accountable?
What are you talking about? The fans do what their job is. They show up and support the team. They pay their money.
Do you know
they listen to sports radio. They watch the games. They listen to the games. They buy your jersey. They cheer when you do still the coolest intro I've ever seen with the big turnaround with his arms spread wide like an airplane. Like, fans do their job. Well, accountability? What? What is that?
You know there's peregrine falcons in Lumen Field? That's why they can't fly a hawk because they're afraid they will kill the hawk. Who's going to hold the falcons accountable? I mean, that's
the fastest bird in the world.
Level. Yes.
This is a bit of a reach, but okay, yeah, let's go with that.
Are they just going to go after Tama the hawk?
Tama goes into the stands
happen?
And like jumps on a guy's head. Where's the accountability
What's
for
next?
Hawks?
Blitz? Boom? What's going on?
Now Kyle's really
I was
going to
say,
excited.
Kyle's actually now being serious.
Well, he's and if we could rid Lumen Field of all birds.
Seagulls, get them out of here.
Kyle's ready to declare war on the birds, let alone accountability.
And the seagulls that come after the game are going to get me started.
It's true. Okay, well, so there you go.
Well, sure. What does he say? You know, these fans never won anything until we got them a Super Bowl. Yeah, they sniffed something in 05. They celebrated.
You either die the hero.
Yeah.
Are you live long enough to become the villain?
Pause. And just pause that for a moment. Just pause. There has never been a phrase created that was designed more to remove accountability from the equation.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, who wrote The Dark Knight? Whoever wrote that
Christopher
movie.
Christopher Nolan.
Christopher Nolan wrote it? I know he directed it.
I probably wrote it.
Yeah, he gets credit.
Howdy says with
it's
great confidence.
Everybody yes.
Christopher
his
Nolan
movie.
Wrote it.
Yes.
Maybe he did. Mm-hmm. Whoever wrote that line, and I don't know if it existed somewhere before The Dark Knight or whatever, but There's never been a line written better designed to eliminate the words accountability from anything. Well, it just happens.
Well, I just became the villain.
Right? You are a hero, and then just over time, you're going to naturally become the villain. You don't take any action whatsoever in making that happen. Just by sheer life like continuing, you will automatically become the villain. It takes away even an ounce of accountability to the entire process.
Yep.
That the person involved, the hero-villain turn, just happens without them taking even a small role in it.
Mm-hmm. It's an inevitability.
It literally diminishes the role of accountability as much as... Right, you can continue. Sorry. That's just a side note.
And everybody's learning that the hard way. Russell's learning that. You either leave the hero or you stay long enough to become the villain. Because no matter what, these fans had never won anything before we got here. Yeah. They had never won anything. They went to the Super Bowl in 06 and we're happy to be there, you know? Yeah. And that was their biggest claim. And then we get there, we win the Super Bowl, we spoil them with historic defense, and then all of a sudden that's their expectation. Now their expectation is oh, we're going to the Super Bowl every year.
Oh,
you want to wonder if he's talking about the fans?
Oh, it makes me shiver. Whoa,
there's
dude.
Like four shots at the fans.
Holy
in there.
Holy smokes. Talk about widespread generalization.
You know, it's so funny because yesterday I was kind of worked up and upset about this. Today, I don't know. I'm glad somebody's finally holding these fans accountable. I'm on Sherm's side, I guess. Honestly, jokes aside, listening to that day two, it's worse than I realized day one. Mm-hmm. Like listening to it with you guys and here, I mean, I spent a ton of time talking about this yesterday on the show. What do you guys hear when you hear that?
What I've always heard from Sherm, like he's looking out for Sherm. I mean, that's why he's his own agent in the end. That's why he never took accountability. That's why when Cam and the guys tried to surround him on the field after busting an assignment, he would never take accountability. It's why he poked in fun at Pete on the way out. It's why he scorched earth in many ways on the way out. Like, I'd love someone to counsel Sherm and say, what are you doing? What is the upside of what you're trying to do right now? Like, I know you want to have a podcast and you want to have strong opinions, and you do, but my goodness gracious, just insulting the fans that love you, that filled that stadium, that adored you, that are fanatics, and they're fanatics for a reason, because that's what a fan is. They're fanatical about their team, and sheesh, to just scorch them now. For what purpose?
The other thing that dawns on me, and I, you know, this is maybe a touchy subject to get into. I mean, it was what, last summer that Sherm was arrested, right? And we get the reports of him trying to break down the door and then eventually driving after drinking a tremendous amount of alcohol, ultimately crashing the car. Thankfully, nobody was hurt, but certainly plenty of people were put at risk and could have been injured as a result of his actions. We heard afterwards about, you know, and I think some very real talk. We talked about it like, hey, there's some level of sympathy here and how hard it must be for him and covering up some of, you know, the demons. And, you know, maybe it's about leaving the league or injuries or just, you know, the challenges of and what he's going to do to try to face these demons head on and get the help that he needs. And there does sound like there'd be a level of accountability there. Hearing him talk like this now, and I know the two things aren't related, so maybe I'm making a leap in my head. I'll own it if I am.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sound like somebody who is in the process of learning to take more accountability and deal with his own issues.
No.
It sounds like somebody who is back to blaming everybody else for what's going on in the world.
We've always known that he has made himself great by believing there's an enemy out there that's always after him and out to get him. He needs opposition
and now
all
it's
the time.
Seahawks fans?
And he just is now looking for it. What team is he with? What is he support? Like, who is his identity connected to now? What's his enemy? He's always had it, but when that goes away, what's left?
Well,
go to the next thing closest.
And
to
I
you.
Do think it's interesting, and not to get too like psychoanalysis on this, but you know, the rest of these cuts and a lot of this is all about, you know, well, they can't move on from Bobby and they screwed up moving on from us. And once you do, you know, you're rebuilding and it's toast and this and that. And it does sound a little bit like someone trying to come to terms with his own mortality as a football player. His time in the NFL is coming to an end.
Yes.
Maybe it'll be this year, maybe not, but it's definitely nearing the
end.
He's
well past his peak, never going to be the player he once was.
Right, and he got injured, he couldn't really play this year. I mean, like, it seems like he's probably, if not totally done, nearly done. And he's kind of, I'm sure, just like I feel every time the calendar ticks over another year and I get older, I'm feeling worse and worse about that. And I don't blame him for feeling that sense of mortality, but it's interesting.
Why lash out at the fans?
Well, I feel like he's just sort of upset and just lashing out at anybody.
Everybody?
And so he's sort of giving these takes that are, they're so the opposite of what made him Richard Sherman. This idea of, he says it later, 85% of the linebackers out there can't do what Bobby Wagner does. First of all, that's just not true anymore. Like, I love you, sure. That's not true. I love Bobby. That's not true. We watched him this year. Cody Barton did 85% or more, maybe 185% of what Wagner did in two games. So stop. That. And nobody thinks Cody Barton is the second coming. But he was just as good as Bobby when we watched him. So, like, I'm not sure he's right on. What he's doing is falling into the exact trap he was trying to expose when he was a young player. Do you remember the Darrell Revis stuff?
Oh, do I remember? Yes.
Well, I'm just proud of myself for remembering. So
oh, I'm sorry.
I don't mean to make it seem...
You got the name right. Let's close the segment.
All right. Do you remember? No, I mean, for those who don't...
Oh, he went after him. I'm the best in the game. He put up his stats, his interceptions, his numbers. You know, it's not even close. I mean,
it wasn't just that. It was, you guys all think Darrell Revis is the best in the game because he used to be and has a big name. I'm actually the best in the game. And if you look at the other stats and you look at the impact and you look at this, remember he went down to the Super Bowl and was at New Orleans and was like holding up like, hey, do you know who Richard
Sherman
is? Yeah,
he's out on Bourbon Street interviewing, like man on the street.
Hey, do you know who Richard Sherman is? No, you know who Darrell Revis is? Yeah.
You know Nnamdi Asomugha?
Yeah. Right? And he was showing like, hey, look at these stats versus those. He was trying to point out that guys get to a point in the NFL career where their name carries a lot more weight than their play. Isn't that like exactly where Bobby Wagner is? And Bobby doesn't do it with the same sort of outward arrogance that Darrell Revis did. There's not like a Bobby Wagner Island.
He's not doing it at all.
He's not doing it at all. It's just being done for him. So this is not Bobby's fault. No one's blaming him. He's not the bad guy. But in this scenario, isn't Bobby Wagner right now kind of Darrell Revis when Richard Sherman was a kid?
Yeah. Yeah. And Richard is doing exactly what he hated a decade ago. Right, what he tried to attack and go after, and he's doing that now, and it sounds unfortunately like a bitter old player, and it sounds like, as I would say to him, like, you know, there's opportunity to get in the media, and there's going to be many a door that are going to open for you because of your resume, because of your strong takes, because of your emotion, because of your opinion, but tearing down others to do that.
I think his answer, and I'll presume to speak for Sherm, which is probably a mistake, but I think what he would say in a quiet moment is, dude, I don't want to work in the media. Look at what Pat McAfee's doing. I do my own thing. I don't need Fox or ESPN or NBC or anything like that to get my opinion out. I can do my own podcast. I'm going to grow it into something big. You guys are all talking about my opinion. I didn't need to go on Fox in order to do it. Yep. Pat McAfee gets, 6 million views on his YouTube channel every time? What the heck do I need? I don't need the media. This is just his opportunity, I think he would say,
to get rid of the whole media. It's what he did for, 12 months or so. Now, he went and worked for ESPN. He jumped off boats on game day, and then he did WWE, and he kind of grew his brand, as he would tell you. He did all that to build the
brand. But he also needed to in a way that Sherm does not. I mean, Sherman is one of the most famous football players on the planet, whereas Pat McAfee was a punter.
Yep. So if he wants to go...
I don't say that insultingly, but Pat did what he needed to do to build up the resume, to get people know who he
and what
was,
if FanDuel,
and then he's turned it into something
gigantic.
What if FanDuel
pay them $120 million or something?
So, I mean, if you're Sherm, he's going, dude, I don't go take a $2 million a year job from Fox. Dude, I'm good. Yep. I'm going to build this thing into what Pat McAfee's done, and I'm going to make $10 million.
No bosses, my own terms.
Exactly. I don't need any of that. I'm smarter than any one of those executives.
My own facts.
And you might be right.
Yeah. My own truth, my own view, my own spin.
But still, that doesn't...
Tearing down the 12s? Tearing down... trying to hold the 12s accountable? Can we hold them accountable?
If I hear Richard Sherman use the phrase 12 since 12, that'll be it. That'll be the funniest thing I've ever heard. I hope with the next podcast, Sherman says 12 since 12. If he says that, I mean, that would be
12 since 12. These guys are on the 12th man.
If I hear Sherm say 12 since 12, that will be hysterically funny.
Why you got to tear down Meow Sean Lynch? What did Meow Sean Lynch do?
Yeah, tell that to Richard Perman.
Do you think that Richard Perman, the famed cat that came to one of our shows, along with Meow Sean Lynch, do you think Richard Perman doesn't care for accountability?
I just hope Richard Perman's still kicking somewhere. He's got to be closing in on 10 years old now.
Nine lives. Cats live off forever.
Right.
Man.
That was down at the Renton City Hall, I think, with Mayor Dennis Law. Long arm of the law. Who could forget that guy brought two cats to a radio show at a fan rally?
I think he was wearing a kilt, too.
How did he do that?
I think he had a kilt and two cats.
He had them on his shoulders like parrots. He's like a dual domesticated pirate.
Meow, Sean and Richard Perman.
And don't That's who Sherm's talking. Sherm wants accountability for that guy. Hey, how come nobody's counting this guy accountable? This guy used to have Richard Perman, and then he changed its name to Shaquille Meowshin or whatever. Like,
Mama Blue, what about the Seahawk, huh? Just getting away with anything. It's ridiculous.
All right, Brock, from maybe some of the fun of Richard Sherman to what I think has the capability to be an explosive story. I was talking with Andrew Brandt about this today, and I think this story, I don't know if it ends up being as big as, you know, mid-70s and getting rid of the reserve clause in baseball and ushering in free agency or Jackie Robinson or, you know, some of these absolute gigantic change the game forever kind of moments. But the Brian Flores lawsuit, especially, again, this is a class action lawsuit. If he's joined by other coaches in the league, does have the opportunity to be incredibly explosive and potentially bigger even than the concussion lawsuit and everything that that did to change the game and the way it's played. I think this has really major potential repercussions depending on how it goes.
Do you think there can be change from it?
I think there's going to have to be.
I mean, that would be, I was watching Brian Flores today and his two attorneys this morning on Get Up with Greenberg, and he did the circuit of you know, a lot of the different news stations. And that was, you know, Mike Greenberg did a good job, kind of laid out the three biggest claims of Elway being disheveled and drunk in their meeting. Obviously, the owner of the Dolphins, you know, telling him, hey, you know, I'll fly you. You're working too hard. I'll pay you $100,000, a lot, you know, all of that, which I think has enormous ramifications as well, right next to it.
Sure.
And then obviously the charge that these Rooney rule that was put into place for a good practice to try to expand opportunity has actually been a sham for many, and his belief that Belichick knew ahead of time and you know, sent obviously the wrong text to the wrong guy and really exposed the sham in his estimation that this Rooney rule was put in place to fix. And so they go through it, and ultimately Mike Greenberg said to him at the end, what do you want from this? Mm-hmm. And Flores said, you know, I want change. And Mike pressed him further and said, well, what kind of change? And at that, and it was honestly, it was probably a 5-second pronounced just pause of him trying to, you know, like, that's a good question. I guess in the hearts of people, I want legitimate change, at them to feel as comfortable, them being the owners and the decision makers, with a white man as they do a black man walking into that room. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was profound.
So can I back up on that a little bit? Because the lawsuit itself kind of speaks to some of this, right? So first of all, you know, it's important to note he is suing for change. He's not really suing for money. And I didn't really necessarily understand that when you and I spoke earlier today, Brock. I hadn't talked to Brandt yet, and he kind of helped me understand this. He is suing for injunctive change. Right. It is injunctive, not necessarily monetary. Mm-hmm. So what he's looking for, that doesn't mean that there's not a monetary component to this, but this is not $100 million lawsuit. This is an injunctive lawsuit. He is looking for the court to step in and make the NFL change its behavior rather than to give him a payoff. To me, that's important, partially because it legitimizes how important this is to him. He's not looking for a payout. He's not looking to make a buck. Whatever, like, you can't levy that charge at him. Not that you are, but a person cannot say, hey, this guy's just looking to get paid after he didn't get a job. He's looking for $100 million. Right. He's not really looking for that. He seems to have an honest to goodness desire to see the NFL change its ways and open it up to more African Americans, more inclusion in general. And it was interesting talking to Hasselbeck today. I didn't know this. Did you know Brian Flores was college roommates with Tim Hasselbeck?
No.
Yeah, they were college roommates at BC.
Interesting.
Yeah, and he said Flores is like all-time great human. Like, unbelievable leader, principal, just all-timer in terms of a great guy. So, I think that's just one man's opinion, but I think all of those things are sort of relevant as you're trying to determine, hey, how serious is this lawsuit? How serious should I take him? Based on those two things, I would say very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing Brandt was telling me, Andrew Brandt from SI was telling me, is that the goals here are for things like transparency in hiring, transparency in pay. Are you paying one coach more than another? Is there a pattern to be seen in terms of how much black coaches get paid versus white coaches? The NFL has traditionally resisted any form of transparency. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's an interesting argument to be made about collusion, et cetera. And so he is seeking a level of transparency, both in the interview process, the hiring process, the pay process, et cetera. So that, and some, you know, bringing, not to bring Sherm's word back into this, a level of accountability to the way the process is working. Is that going to fix everything? No, of course not. So when he says he's looking for change and can't put a finger on how it fixes what's in the hearts of people, I don't think he's got a way to do that. But I also, I think that by looking for transparency and things like, those are things that are mandatory in every business except the NFL.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the things that are commonplace in today's big business.
Yes, and I think that transparency is a legitimate first step, and I hope a win in this. You know, the Denver Broncos would turn around and say, whoa, 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 as they did, hey, we've got the notes, Mike. Actually, this is a big business, and this hiring process is a big deal, and we've walked through it too many times now because we've been a disaster of an organization for the last 4 or 5 years, and we've turned over, and we've turned over, and we've turned over, and here's our notes from that meeting. Here's the 4 hours, and here's the five people involved, and you know, I was listening to the GM out here in Denver, Peyton, talk about the 8 candidates that they went through and traveling to see them all and all of the notes. I think that there already is a ton of that going on, but not everywhere. And I think that is what Flores is trying to illuminate.
But I think he's also trying to eliminate the, hey, this is just a token interview.
Correct.
Right. And I think he's got a pretty darn good case that what happened to him in New York sure sounds like a check the box kind of an interview. I think that another guy who's going to have a real interesting case right now is Patrick Graham. And I don't know whether he ends up, or if you know the name, if he ends up becoming a part of this also. But Patrick Graham was the current defensive coordinator at the New York Giants, used to be with the Patriots as well. And he has just went for a second interview with the Vikings. I don't know whether they are going to hire Jim Harbaugh, but I'd bet my house that they will.
They will.
I don't believe there's a chance that Jim Harbaugh is going to go for a chance at a job interview in Minnesota on National Signing Day and risk torching his entire future in Michigan unless he knows pretty darn well he's getting that job, which means Patrick Graham just interviewed for nothing. That was just a show interview. They're just going to hire Harbaugh, who hasn't even interviewed for the job. They knew they scheduled that interview with Harbaugh before the second interview with Patrick Graham. And so that second interview is a sham.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to hire Patrick Graham. Maybe I'll be proven wrong and he ends up getting the job. And
what if they want him to be the D coordinator? What if they want to learn more
about
him?
That's not what he's interviewing for. He's been a D coordinator.
What if their new GM is going to say, I want to get to know all of these candidates. And yeah, I have a relationship with Jim Harbaugh and we were in San Francisco and he's got a better resume and he's a better coach than Patrick Graham and he's more proven track record and I want to hire him.
You are bringing up, Brock, one of the original intents, to my understanding, of the Rooney Rule was not just to give the person interviewing the best chance to get that job,
correct,
but to open them up and have those conversations so that maybe the next job comes to them. Hey, we didn't hire Patrick Graham this time, but the next time I'm going to remember that I had a great interview, even though I just was quote unquote checking the box with Patrick Graham, the next time I'm going to remember that was a great interview. And so I'm going to call him back and he's going to be my next coach. That was some of my understanding of the original intent of the Rooney Rule, but it hasn't worked. Right. I mean, you look at where you're at now, just percentage wise, it hasn't worked well enough to be considered a success. So I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad strategy or that that didn't have good intentions, but that's not enough, right? At the end of the day, you got to be able to do more than that.
Yeah, where I'm a little torn on this, I think I told you this on your show earlier this week. I was listening to Chad Brown talk about this, and I love Chad Brown. Chad Brown, an old teammate of mine, does media in the Denver market, does national games on radio and travels around. Just a bright guy. He and I have had a lot of deep conversations over the years, look at the world a little bit differently at times, and it's led to some fun, deeper conversations. And he brought up an interesting point, Mike, and I got to thinking about this today. I was doing a little yard work. And there's a lot of isms that are problems in the NFL. narcissism. And Chad was bringing this to light as well. And Chad has been an interim coach and done some of the training camps and everything else, and thought maybe he wanted to get into coaching. So he'd been around, and narcissism is a big problem. The leader that just wants yes men around them, that won't tell them the emperor's clothes are not on. That won't tell them you're wrong on this. That won't tell them that's a bad practice. That won't tell them that just simply want to stay employed. I want to stay employed in this league. This is a great league. I mean, my goodness gracious, everybody watches it, make a lot of money doing it. Stadiums are amazing. Like, this is the best of the best. So there's a narcissism problem. I still think there's an anti-Semitism problem in places. I think that there is a nepotism problem for in sure. a lot of places. Mm-hmm. I think there is a racism problem in places still. So I think there's a lot of isms. That nepotism is a big deal. Go look around the league and see how many people are in the league just because they share the last name of a coach in that league and get an opportunity ahead of others that are more warranted, that have a better resume, that have more of a track record, that are itching and climbing and serving and working decades in college football to get in the door. Sorry. Yep. My son's going to get that job because I want to get him in this league. And that's all over the league. That's not just, obviously, Pete had two boys that, and this is no shot at those two, because it goes on everywhere. Belichick's son's the D coordinator in New England. Zimmer's son, Gary Kubiak's son, Shanahan. Go around the league, Mike. It is incredible how many and how much nepotism goes on in the NFL. Is that, you know, and you know, what is going to be the fix for that? Is there a fix for that? Should be there a fix for that? Should be there at least transparency with, okay, mm-hmm. you know, how did you get this position? How did you get in the door here? How did this work? So there are a lot of isms in the, you know, in, and this was, I think, one of the really good points that Brian Flores made. And I think you'll continue to hear him say this. And I think he's right on this. Everyone looks to the NFL. It is a lead. It is a leader in business. It is a leader culturally. It is a leader in our communities for right, wrong, and different. It is the powerhouse that can make such an impact. And what he wants is an impact of change for mm-hmm. more of this transparency.
I think that's really well said. And they do have the opportunity to do it. They've responded by saying there's no value yeah. to this lawsuit whatsoever. So yeah. I don't know whether they're necessarily seeming like that's the interest that they have right now. I thought that was just terrible. Yeah. And I know maybe there's legal reasons for it. Generally, when people do things that are so outrageously beyond the pale, mm-hmm. you find out later, like, oh, okay, like they have to do it for legal reasons.
Right.
But God, is it pathetic. Yeah. It is so pathetic to immediately, an hour later, come out and say that, yeah, there's no merit here. How do you know that?
Right.
If you work at Amazon, if you work at Boeing, if you work at Starbucks, if you work at Costco, and there's an HR concern like this, you think they're just like, eh, nothing. Every one of those companies, at least I sure hope, needs to go through an HR investigation at that point needed in order to determine what's going on. The NFL is like, eh, we're all good here. Mm-hmm. Nothing to see here. Thanks. I appreciate what you have to say there about all the isms that still exist in the NFL, and I'm sure there's a lot of truth to all of that. The idea of systemic racism is interesting to me because it doesn't fit as neatly into those boxes. And it's a little bit, I think, of a hard concept to understand, and I'm not entirely sure I understand it. So I'm kind of, as I said, walking out on a limb here a little bit and trying to do the best I can. And I've talked to some folks about it, and they seem to concur with this view of it. When the talk here is of structural racism in the NFL, it is not necessarily accusing any individual of having hate in their heart. It doesn't necessarily accuse an owner or a decision maker of going home and using the N-word or having disparaging things to say about any group of people or specifically making a decision based on race in their own mind. If I understand the idea, it means not necessarily that any one of these hires was made with race in mind. It's that the system is set up in such a way that it is challenging or impossible or harder for minorities to advance, and that something must be done to break that cycle. So it may be as quote unquote innocent as an owner wants to hire somebody who they connect with. But if that owner generally connects, if all 32 owners are white and those people generally connect with people that look like them or talk like them or have a shared experience to them in some way, it becomes significantly more challenging for a person of color to get hired. And they say, well, I didn't not like that person. I like Jim Harbaugh. It's not that I don't like Patrick Graham. I like Jim Harbaugh. I know a lot about him. I went to Michigan. He went to Michigan. Okay. But you're ignoring the fact that that in and of itself is challenging for the person who isn't like one of the owners and might not be immediately accepted as a similar type of person by that owner. And there's no hate involved. Nobody is sitting, and this is why I know people can get, I don't want to use the word triggered because I know that triggers people in its own right. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't mean that, but like, I know why people immediately get defensive and push back. Hey, I'm not racist. I didn't say that. I don't hate anybody. I don't see color. That's okay. No one is accusing you of that. No one is accusing necessarily any of the people, John Mara or any of the people involved here, of that. The accusation is that the system is set up in such a way, not even necessarily on purpose, but it de facto discriminates against people and doesn't give them enough opportunity to succeed, which is why you end up in a situation where currently you only have one NFL head coach who is black, and that the percentage of black head coaches over the years has never come close to mirroring even, you know, what the players' percentage of players is, or even, you know, a reasonable percentage.
What do they say in business? I think there's a common axiom in business that says people do business with people they enjoy doing business with, right? That they enjoy, that they like to your words, that you can connect with. I hope in time, and I really do believe this in time, and the NFL has taken huge strides in this way over the course of even the 25 years when I was a player and being around it and watching it and broadcasting games in it now and being at practices and seeing it, Mike, there is much more diversity on staffs, much more diversity in training rooms, much more diversity in management. There were some dynamic general managers hired in
this.
That's
true, but Brock, there's zero diversity in ownership.
But the owners don't make those head coaching decisions.
They're involved.
I mean, they're pretty involved.
They're pretty involved.
There's a bunch of them that aren't involved.
But John Mara was involved and Stephen Ross was involved. I mean, like,
there are places where they're not. And I believe that the GM and the Wilfs empowered their GM to make this hire. He's making this hire because he's connected with Jim Harbaugh in the past, that he likes doing business with Jim Harbaugh. Mm-hmm. You know, that in that that's a step that has to take, that has to be taken in the management
side. The problem
side
you run into, though, Brock, and look, the Minnesota Vikings may have every good reason in the world for hiring Jim Harbaugh over Patrick Graham. Connection, better resume. The problem is, it's when there's an individual excuse on every single one of these potential hires, at some point something's got to break that chain, right? You know, yeah, okay, this individual one seems fine, and this individual one seems fine, and this individual one, but sooner or later they add up to 30 out of 30, and you're like, okay, well, I get that they all make sense in a vacuum, but that doesn't make sense as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the challenge that Brian Flores is trying to fight for.
Yep.
And I support it. I think it's good on him. It's an incredibly brave decision. And for him to go through with this, I hope it leads to some change. But I will agree that I think it's very challenging to make that happen.
I think here's the thing that will have to happen. And I do believe this will happen in the next decade. And I don't know if it will be with the Jets, with Robert Saleh. I don't know if, you know, Zach Wilson can be Joe Burrow. I don't think he can. But had a Joe Burrow gone to a Todd Bowles? Had a Joe Burrow gone to a Vance Joseph? Mm-hmm. Had a Joe Burrow gone to a Steve Wilkes? Right? Had a Joe Burrow gone to David Coley in Houston? Had a dynamic generational quarterback, Josh Allen, Joe Burrow, Patrick Mahomes, landed with one of those coaches, one of those young coaches, one of those that has to prove it, right? That gets in the door and I got to win and I got to prove and I got to do even a little bit more to change this game, to break through this ceiling.
But I mean,
I think that is going to happen in the next 10 years.
It could, but the flip side of that argument is a lot of those coaches barely got an opportunity to find that guy. And if you kind of go through what happened with both Flores in Miami, David Culley in Houston, and what Hugh Douglas is alleging in Cleveland, all three black coaches were essentially hired as scapegoats. They were hired to fail.
To fall guys.
They were hired to be fall guys. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. I mean, David Culley, by all accounts, did a pretty good job of developing that random dude. In
Davis Mills.
There you go. He didn't get a Kyler Murray. He got a Davis Mills. And he still did a pretty good job of developing that guy to the point where everyone's like, dude, he might actually be pretty good. David Culley canned, never gave him a legitimate contract even long enough to really, you know, take care of the guy. They were always going to fire him. It was a fool's errand. What happens to Brian Flores in Miami? Oh, you're here, but I want you to lose. So let's say he does lose. He loses 15 games. They, instead of getting Tua, they get Burrow. You think he's around in order to develop him? No. He gets canned. How long was Steve Wilkes around? Steve Wilkes ends up with 1 year. He has a terrible record. He gets fired. Number one overall pick. Who do they bring in? A guy who was a complete and utter failure, Brock, in college. Yes. Had just taken an offensive coordinator job because he got fired from being a head coach. And they bring him in to be the coach of the brand new number one overall pick.
So you think
Steve Wilkes didn't even have a shot to work with Kyler Murray.
You think Joe Burrow would have gone to Miami and led Brian Flores in year three to the Super Bowl? You think he's gone?
I'm saying Brian Flores doesn't get 3 years with Joe Burrow. Brian Flores
two
gets. I'm saying he doesn't get 1 year. Steve Wilkes didn't even get a year. He didn't even get an opportunity. He was the fall guy for the bad team. They fired him, and it's like, well, now that we got a number one overall pick, Kyler Murray, let's bring in Cliff Kingsbury, who's a complete failure in college. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that if Brian Flores is being paid to tank down the stretch, I don't know that he even gets the next year after he gets Joe Burrow, let alone being given a second year if the first year doesn't go all that well like Zach Taylor got. Again, it's not... There's ways to kind of talk your way around this, and no one really knows. Maybe Brian Flores would have gotten that opportunity, and he would have had unbelievable success with Joe Burrow. But there's too many of these examples to discount the fact that it sure can you paint a real nasty picture of what these NFL owners and decision makers are doing to the limited opportunities that black coaches even get to be head coaches.
Yep.
It's tough, man.
It is. I think, and I don't think any of that is, like, I don't put a blind eye to that whatsoever.
And I'm not accusing you of doing so.
And I really do hope that in the next 5 to 10 years, we see young, dynamic, because right now it is young, dynamic, offensive-minded white guys that are, right, the final four in the playoffs. I hope in time we find young, dynamic, maybe defensive-minded, offensive-minded, who knows? Maybe Byron Leftwich gets that job, maybe in Jacksonville, and the young QB can actually take a step, and their roster can build, and there's a GM that is competent, and they can grow that thing together, and Byron Leftwich can turn Jacksonville around, and all of a sudden, like, yep, you know, because this is a copycat league. Right, it is the hiring process, and why did Cliff Kingsbury get that job? Well, we got to have Sean McVay. We got to have the next Kyle Shanahan. Why did the guy here in Denver get that? Well, we got to have the next young, smart, offensive whiz guy. That's what we need. That's what the league has right now, and everybody just seems to follow suit in a copycat league with that methodology. I really do hope. I really do. Maybe this is just hope and a fool's errand, but I hope in 5 to 10 years, we do have young, dynamic, passionate African-American men that reach their locker rooms, maybe offensively, maybe defensively, and ignite it and win championships. Because
those guys are out there that haven't gotten the chance. I think Chris Richard is a name that will come up. He's a player a coach you specifically talked about over and over again, saying he's got the kind of head coach mentality and passion, and he's inspiring, etc. And his time kind of came and went. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have talked about Eric Bieniemy, and you talk about a mind. I mean, the guy didn't even really get an interview this year. Now, I don't know. Maybe there's something about him in particular that is preventing that. But you talk about sharp, young offensive mind. What's been a better offensive system than Kansas City's?
Second half last week.
Well, all right, that's fine. point taken.
Don't forget about that.
But over the last couple of years, I mean, come on. I mean, he's an offensive coordinator that, by all accounts, if that was what Denver was looking for, where was that? Right? I mean, he fits the bill as young, sharp offensive mind. I don't know. It really feels like they are giving more opportunities to white candidates, fewer opportunities to black candidates. It may not have anything to do with the hate in anybody's heart, But the system at the moment sure seems to be not working in favor of the black candidates to be head coaches and more in the NFL. Of course, we are now getting ready for a huge game just over a week from now. We'll be talking more about that here in a minute. Whether you're a Cincinnati or an LA fan, Brock, or maybe you're secretly stewing over the Seahawks or whatever, you can cheer your team on famously with Famous Dave's Barbecue for the big game next Sunday. All the barbecue classics to satisfy any craving. Famous Dave's will get you through. Famously, would you like some menu highlights of what you might be able to do while you're hanging out, having a little party at home?
Mm-hmm.
Start a little appies, little appetizers. You want to go sampler platter? Southside rib tips, chicken strips, onion strings, traditional wings or boneless wings, tossed in your choice of sauce.
Yes, I'll take them all.
Kind of let that hang out there for a few minutes. Huh? How's that sound?
That's like my gut would be after I was eating.
Just hanging out.
Hanging out.
Excited about that.
You want to go feast for two? How about a half rack St. Louis style spare ribs? What's the difference between that and rib tips?
Howdy?
Spare ribs and rib
full
tips?
On rib ribs versus just a tip of a rib?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, rib tips is the part that's the outside of the rib.
I'm all about a spare rib. Six bones, half a country roasted or barbecue chicken, choice of Texas beef brisket or Georgia chopped pork, creamy coleslaw, Famous fries, Wilbur beans, sweet corn, cornbread muffins. That's going to serve family style 2 to 3 people. It's only $50, $49.99. You can do 1, 2, or 3 meat combo platters, a la carte options, kids meals if your kids don't like all that and more. You can go salad if that's kind of the way you operate. Sandwiches, burgers, even dessert like the award-winning bread pudding. Yes, sir. It's pretty good on a Sunday. Planning a larger gathering for the game. They'll also cater famously full service delivery and pickup options. To watch the big game famously, call or order online at famousdaves.com. Brock, we've been talking all seriously. Let's talk a little football. We're here, just watched AFC, NFC championship games, barely even had a chance to talk about it. I have been feeling, I think I've told you,
I know you're furious.
Not even just furious, just like my foundational beliefs about the NFL and quarterback play have all been shaken.
You need Mike has been so Brock. Dejected.
Brock. Oh my God.
He has been wandering around like
emo?
Charlie Brown, sticking
Suzuki?
His head in his own chest. His head is so sunken.
Tidbits or takeaways on Monday, and it was
he couldn't finish his sentences.
Sean McVay stinks, and Matt Stafford's the worst.
So when you guys watch him walk to his car in the parking lot, head down, the anti-howdy, shoulders back, just chest out, arms flailing.
The gate is not like Howdy's at the moment. No, it's been a sad couple of weeks. I feel like everything I thought I knew about the NFL has just been turned on its head. Matt Stafford is in the Super Bowl. Are you kidding me?
Been trying to tell you this for years, Mike.
Stop it.
Been trying to tell you he's a good quarterback stuck on a bad team, and you told me he wasn't.
So let me relay something. So I will relay a story, and I'm kind of curious what you guys will say about this.
Do you want our help or do you want our badgering? What do you want here?
Both.
Let's set this final segment up appropriately. Both. What do you want from us?
I want both. A little help and a little badgering.
All right.
So I was talking to my favorite quarterback, Matt Hasselbeck, today.
Favorite ex-Seahawks.
When is that segment done, by the way? I think it is done. When is it?
I think just 1 or 2 more weeks. I promise. Okay. We'll be done with the Hasselbeck. So I was talking to my favorite ex-Seahawks quarterback, Matt Hasselbeck, and I asked him, what is the most important quality in a quarterback these days? Because, we talk about...
Oh,
right.
Good. Yeah.
We talk about accountability accuracy and we talk about decision making, arm strength, athleticism has crept in there more in the last few years. Right, Brock?
Mm-hmm.
We talk about availability and how important that is. I know you often mention relatability as being one of the most important abilities and how big that's been for Tom Brady and for Joe Burrow. What do you think Matt Hasselbeck said was the most important ability for a quarterback in 2022?
Ooh.
I don't think I've ever heard you mention this ability, by the way.
Interesting.
And it's not to say you don't believe it, but I don't think, I could be wrong, my memory's not great, as anyone will tell you. I don't think I've ever heard
ability.
You mention
it's
this.
It's something that has...
It ends with ability.
It ends with
the
ability?
The best ability is availability.
Right, but it's not availability, it's not dependability.
Not coachability.
Accountability has been a theme.
What was that, Howdy?
Coachability.
Coachability.
What?
Coachability.
According to Matt,
really?
I asked Matt today, what is the most important quality? He said... coachability. And he pointed because I said, look, man, I'm feeling the Stafford thing has me in knots. What the heck? And he's like, I think everything you said about Stafford is correct. But he learned and was able to be coached by Sean McVay into fixing a lot of that stuff.
Interesting.
And in the middle of this year, he went back to being old Matt Stafford and was throwing the ball away and giving it to, you know, trying to force it to his best receivers and throwing picks and all that. And the tape is really ugly. And through coachability, he was able to improve upon who he's always been.
Did he go to great lengths to tell you why that he believes in that so strongly?
No.
He didn't? He didn't go to great lengths to tell you your favorite former Seahawk quarterback who had to learn right. that trait more than any other trait. And that was the only reason.
You've told me that.
Yeah. I mean, that, and he would tell you that. Like, I'm not speaking out of turn. He would tell you flat out. I was uncoachable. Came to Seattle, thought I knew everything. Yeah, this is why Brett Favre did it. Okay. Like, I got it, Mike. All right. I know. Chapter 15. I'm on chapter 15. I got it. I know what a Tom call is. We'll just slide the line. We'll just, no, we're not doing that, Matt. Matthew, we are going to go back to chapter one because we're installing this. We're starting over. We're not in Green Bay anymore, and you don't have 15 years of experience like Brett. Knock it off. Okay, fine. Let's go back to chapter seven then. I got the first six. Let's go to seven. No. We'll go back to chapter one. I'm not going back to chapter one. You brought me here. You traded for me. A first rounder. You pay me millions of bucks. Like, I'm the guy. Okay, sit on the bench. Dilfer's
going to play. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And that was, he had no coachability. None. Zero. Zip. And then, you know, thankfully, I think for Matt, Jim Zorn came alongside him. I said, are you going to finally listen? And then they did a wise thing. And Matt, that summer, went and coached at some camps and was like, wow, yeah, these kids are punks. Like, they don't even listen. Oh, well, that's me. Like, I don't even listen. Like, I'm not coachable. Mm. You have got to be coachable. That's pretty cool. And I do think it comes from firsthand life experience for him at a career turning point. And when Trent got hurt, he got the job back. He was more talented than Trent, and he never looked back, and he became coachable, and he actually listened. Did he butt heads because he's from the Northeast? Yes. He still butts heads. But
is
was
that a
he.
Thing,
just for
Brock?
Fun. For sport. It's a bit of a thing.
Yes.
By the way, like everything I say on the Hasselbeck show that we do, like literally whatever I say, he's like, yeah, it's not true. And then he just immediately discounts whatever. It's great. I love it. I love arguing with him. It's so fun.
It is a Northeast thing.
Oh, yeah. Of course it is.
He brings some of that flavor. But that's a good, I think, that's real. And when you bring 12 years of baggage to that environment, right, there is a lot to unpack. Yeah, man, I know. I got it, Sean. No, you don't, Matthew. Another Matthew, by the way. Another similar vein between those two. No, you don't, Matthew Stafford. You're going to do it my way. And I'm going to be able to scheme these guys open for you. And how many times in the playoffs, I hope you watch that. I know you were mad. You were seething. You were rooting for him to lose. But I hope you watch that and saw how many times his first option, Tampa Bay and in that game, open. Sean McVay said that to me. Very clearly, you know, he said, my job, especially in the first 15 plays, because he, like many of the West Coast school, scripts their plays, my job is to get you an open receiver, your first look. I need to find you open receiver. Like, I need, that's my job. I spend all week planning, scheming, putting this script together. And your availables and your first options need to be open. That's my job to get you in rhythm. And I thought the last 2 weeks in particular, McVay was spot on with that.
It's so funny because, well, first of all, I love what Matt had to say because it allows me to be right, which is great. It vindicates everything I've always thought about Matt Stafford, but also allows for the idea that people can be coached and can evolve over time. Brock, certainly you've had to kind of deal with the same thing with Josh Allen, right? I know I've been the one sort of out front of him, but somewhat based on your view of a guy can't learn accuracy, and he has.
Right.
He's
That's
become
right.
accurate. It's amazing to see this development where guys have gone from being like, not the type of quarterback I want to, ooh, maybe they can be coached into being the kind of quarterback I want. Now, all that being said, if Jaquaski Tartt can catch.
You think totally, that ends the
say.
Game?
Oh.
It was a 3-point game, 9 minutes and 50 seconds left. It's 17-14, I believe, at that point.
It might end the game.
Do you believe that Jimmy's going to go down and score a touchdown, or are they going to kick a field goal?
I think
20-14.
That it's a real possibility it ends the game. I thought there were three moments that turned the NFC Championship game. The first came before that. It was after the Niners had gotten up 10, and on the next drive, on first down, they called a phantom taunting call on the linebacker, Al-Shaair, I think his name is. I didn't see a thing. I've watched it 5 times. He didn't do anything. I understand that they're trying to... I'm not one of these anti-taunting people either. I'm not insane about the taunting rule. That's the only taunting call I've seen in the postseason. Maybe there's been another
that wasn't the headbutt by Warner?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was that he got up. That was bizarre. They got up after the play. He was walking away and like did something with his hand or something as he was walking away. And they called him for taunting. It was bizarre.
Okay.
So maybe something happened that I didn't see, or they didn't catch it on the camera, or whatever.
What are the other two?
But they gave him 15 yards. Rams went down, scored that touchdown, which ended up completely changing the momentum of the game.
Mm-hmm.
The second was the Jaquiski Tartt drop. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. That is a center fielder camped under a ball just waiting for it to come down, and he drops it.
Yep.
I mean, you got to catch the ball.
Yep.
And then the third was everything that happened in the
final drive.
Yeah, not quite the final drive. No, where they had fourth down. Ooh. It was first, second, and one, then third and two, and then fourth and two.
Should he have gone for it?
Yes.
On fourth down?
Yeah, you had to.
You had to.
Especially him. Especially Kyle Shanahan. Mm-hmm. Knowing what had happened in the Super Bowl to the Patriots, knowing what had happened to him in the past,
yep.
He needed to go for it on fourth down. But he also needed to get it on second or third down.
Yep.
And I think a lot of that is stemming from what? You got Jimmy Garoppolo. Nobody trusts him. Mm-hmm. So they're able to assume the run play and stack the box and all that. And he didn't trust Jimmy.
You get all the way to that place, man, right? You get all the way once again. It was a Super Bowl a couple years ago, and you don't have that trust in the fourth quarter, and you get to this NFC Championship game, you have a lead, but you just do not have that trust factor. And, you know, shame on them. Like, if I'm a 49er fan, shame on them for getting to that place yet again. You should have learned a couple years ago, right? If that was the feeling then, and I know he can grow, and I know he won games, and I know guys believe in him, and I know he has some connection, yada, yada, yada. But when you get push comes to shove to the biggest stage, the most pivotal time, you don't trust him. And, I mean, obviously that's why they drafted Trey Lance last year, and they won't be in that position again with Jimmy G.
No, very clearly. But, I mean, I think those three things end up costing them the game. So, did the Rams win it? Yeah. Did the Niners lose it? Yeah, I think they did in that one. I felt much more strongly that the Chiefs lost the game, though,
yes.
than that the Bengals
by the way,
won it.
Speaking of coachability, I hope Patrick Mahomes watches that second half of his fundamentals, that he gets away with so much, and he's so celebrated, right? Oh, look at this no-look pass. Oh, look at this off-platform. Oh, look at his arm angle. Whoop. Look at this throw, this magical whip-around defenders. It's all awesome. But when push came to shove, his fundamentals in the second half were horrendous when he was clean in the pocket.
Worse than normal?
Yeah. And in the RPO game, and it cost him. Cost him on a pick, cost him on sailing some throws out of the backfield. Like, bro, set your feet, you know, get on top of the ball and put it on him.
So what happened? How does that happen?
It
appeared like whatever happened and went down at the end of the first half, which was inexcusable coaching and quarterbacking.
Correct.
Both guys were inexcusable. Andy Reid, inexcusable to call that play. Patrick Mahomes, inexcusable to throw the ball to that spot behind the line of scrimmage and then think you still had a timeout. All of that was inexcusable. But how does this offense that had been so good and so confident, Patrick Mahomes, the best in the world, how did it affect them that greatly?
I don't know. At home, too?
They're that soft?
At home, right? In your own environment, one of the loudest, I think the loudest, and I'm sorry, Lumenfield, right there
sorry
with Lumenfield.
Sorry to these fans.
Sorry, Malshawn Lynch and Richard Perman. I'm sorry.
So we got to hold them accountable for not being as loud as Kansas City fans.
Oh, in your own building. And I think the best term, I forget if it was Orlovsky or somebody, but they were right. They were chasing. They were even with the lead in the second half at home. You were just chasing that last play of the first half. It felt like you were constantly trying to like prove and get over that and chase it. You could do that on a golf course really easily, man. You miss a birdie putt. Oh my gosh. Next par five, I'm going to get that back. I'm going to drive. I'm going to get on the green.
Right.
No, you're not. You're going to hit it out of OB and then you're going to be chasing and you're going to just be chasing and you could just never get caught up. And I do think his fundamentals got all out of whack. And I will be very curious of this. You know, a couple years ago, got to do a Chiefs game at the end of the season. Fun conversation with Andy Reid. And I remember talking to him. I was like, man, how do you still connect, relate with all these old school West Coast guys? Right? Because it's blue right F short, 200 jet X line. I see it spacing. I see the play. But you let the guys just, he's like, hey man, they've kind of just earned the trust. You remember the Seattle route? It's a sail route, right? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, perfect examples. I'll just call sloppy Seattle and it will give, you know, Kelsey an opportunity to not run the route like Bill Walsh taught it. And like I learned it with Holmgren and like it's taught in a lot of West Coast places. Like, hey man, you got to set this angle here and seven step and boom, boom, rhythm. Like I just trust Patrick and I trust Kelsey. And if I call that, it's kind of give them the leeway to do their thing. They've earned that trust over the years, and it just felt like, man, that play at the end of the first half was the ultimate, like, hey, man, just let the kids play.
No, you can't do that there.
Can't do that.
And, you know, and Patrick Mahomes got to know. I mean, that just, you cannot, you know, if I'm going to criticize Russell for not, you know, for taking the sack and not knowing the situation or playing the situation right in that game here for Seattle this year, then I got to criticize Patrick Mahomes. I mean, like, you can't do that.
It's just the utmost athletic arrogance that nobody's going to tackle Tyreek.
Yeah, you can't think that way. You
and then you let your opponent do it, and guess what? You let your opponent have life and belief and go into a locker room. And how many times going into and out of that game was lost into and out of. They went into it making the play. They got the ball to start it. They got a three and out. And all of a sudden, that other team has so much life.
They didn't help by, you know, forgetting to run the ball in the second half. I mean, that sort of didn't help. And then, you know, you go through, yes, Mahomes and his fundamentals and his accuracy just went in the tank. But even with all of that, you drive down to the 4-yard line. You're at the 4-yard line, second and goal from the 4 with like a minute
and your absolute strength, where you're better than anybody in the league.
You're
your
down
creativity,
three.
You talk about Bieniemy and Andy Reid, like listen to Matt Hasselbeck say this in the pregame on Sunday, like nobody is better in the low red zone and more creative than the Kansas City Chiefs.
Well, they butchered it. And I don't think it was necessarily what they, you know, you had to run the ball there. I'm sorry. On second and goal from the 4, the idea that they drop back to pass was madness.
Yep.
Nothing good can happen.
No, because you're going to take a sack. You're not going to throw it away. At least Patrick knew that, right? I'm not going to throw it away and stop the clock and give the Bengals
your
the ball.
Only options once you drop back to pass were score a touchdown, which gives the other team the ball with plenty of time to go down and score a touchdown themselves, or take a sack, which moves you farther away from being able to take the lead.
Or throw an incomplete, which stops the clock.
Which is a
disaster.
Or
throw an interception, which ends the game.
So there's
nothing good other than one of the 4 outcomes.
One of the 4 outcomes is good. That outcome is similarly good if you run. Yep. And if you don't get in on a running play, you're within 4 yards in all likelihood of trying it again on third down, but 30 seconds down the road. Then you can pass on third down because you're not giving him as much time at the end of the game. How do you drop back to pass? It was bizarre. Honestly, it was bizarre. Yeah. I couldn't have been more surprised to see Patrick Mahomes drop back to pass in that spot. And then because, Brock, and I know you say this all the time, why does Pete Carroll get the bad rap for the Super Bowl? What did Chris Collinsworth say in that moment?
Worst play in the history of the Super Bowl.
What did Tony Romo say during that minute and a half?
Should we let him score here, Jim? Should they let him score? I don't know if they should let him score. What do you think? What should they do here? Should they run the ball? Should they throw the ball? I don't know. Do you think that the Bengals are going to let him score?
He had diarrhea of the mouth for a minute and a half and didn't make one sensible point.
No.
Tony Romo was, I don't know, he became unglued in the end of that game, and it was like all of the energy that he is trying to bring to the broadcast, he forgot that part of the job is to analyze and offer an opinion on what's happening on the field, not just to sound like a slobbering fan.
Yeah.
And in that moment, he offered nothing.
Yep.
If Chris Collinsworth is calling that game and says, that is the most boneheaded call I've seen since the Seahawks lost the Super Bowl.
Yep.
What are people saying about Andy Reid today?
That's what
because he goes back to his old reputation, which is of a guy who had no idea how to handle the clock, couldn't win the big game, and just lucked into Patrick Mahomes. Where's Andy Reid? Where's that conversation? Gone. I didn't hear any of it. Nobody's talking about Andy Reid because Tony Romo's too busy blubbering all over himself in that moment. My God.
Saying they were going to challenge a formation.
That was a few minutes later. Yeah. Oh, my God, that was awful.
Oh, this is brilliant. Andy Reid's going to challenge a formation.
Wait, can he? I don't think he can.
Oh, no, he can. Of course he can't.
What? How that happens in the booth is you say that, and then you look over, and you've got Gene Steratore and whatever his name is.
Gene Steratore.
Looking at you in the booth, shaking his head like,
what?
No, no.
What are you talking about, man? And he was so busy rambling on about the idea of challenging a formation. We have that clip in there, honey, if you want to find it.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
There it is. I'm so glad you found it.
All the way across the sky.
I mean, he was so busy blabbering on about that. They never even showed the fact that, A, there was an illegal formation, and B, he was challenging a fumble.
Yes.
Or trying to anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. What a mess. And so, look, kudos to the Bengals, but I really felt like the Chiefs handed them that game.
I know you hate the organization and it's a cheap ownership and everything else. Do you like Joe Burrow? Is he growing on you?
I don't know how I feel about him yet. I don't know that I've made an opinion
yet.
So
I'm watching. We're watching last night. We watched the first Man in the Ring. I know we're like 3 months
late.
Man in the Arena, you mean? Yeah. Sorry. For the first one with Brady. And it was Macy, icing her ankle, doing some homework. Titus.
I thought that was a person at first. Icing her ankle.
Yeah, Macy, her buddy Icing her ankle.
Yes.
Titus, Molly, me. And the first episode has a lot of... It was basically all Tom taking Drew's job and a lot of Drew and some behind the scenes stuff. I didn't realize Drew said this little anecdote, not to, to ruin it if you want to watch it. But after they win in New Orleans, he flies right to his place in Whitefish and he's on the chairlift 9 hours later, sobbing, sobbing. Like for the first time, he just let all of his emotion out.
From that whole year of being benched and all that.
And it was his team and everything he went through and building it up. And they went back to the Patriots and how bad they were and how Drew got there. And, you know, obviously with Willie and crew kind of turned, it got to the first Super Bowl with Bill. But even that was, is Bill going to be there? And Bill leaves to the Jets.
Meaning Parcells, yeah.
Yes, Parcells. And then Pete comes in, but they're building and the team was getting better and they had these pieces and you could just see it. And Lawyer and Willie McGinnis and Brewski and Vrabel. Like, man, they were good on defense. The O-line was better. Like, this is all built. And then mid-September, right? Tears the artery in his lung. He's out 6 weeks. Doesn't get to play. Ultimately comes back, plays the AFC Championship. And Brady was great. He's like, dude, I was scared. I got, that game was moving too fast. I couldn't play and hurt my ankle. But it was my mind and my confidence as much as my ankle. Like, that, I was not ready. And Drew came in. And then it's like, and even Willie McGee. Yes. And McGinnis is even like, okay, you know, like this is now Drew's team again. Like it's supposed to be finally, you know, like he's going to get the Super Bowl. Nope. Doesn't get to play the Super Bowl. Tom wins the Super Bowl. Obviously clutch, gives him a fist pound at the end of the game. And that was it. And literally flew home to Whitefish, sobbing on the chairlift the next morning.
Was he sobbing about that or the fact that he knew he was about to become a Buffalo Bill? Yeah, no. Drew, in the next part of this chapter, you have to move to Buffalo. And he's like, wait, what? Yeah. I live in Whitefish.
Right. No, I don't think it was about that yet, but it was really good. Anyhow, long story short, as I watched that, it reminded me, and I told Titus and Macy, I said, yeah, in between, you know, them playing the Raiders, Mom and I went to dinner with Tom and his then girlfriend and Damon and Julie. And it's so funny seeing Joe Burrow now. And now seeing that, and it took me back to Tom Brady 20 years ago, right? 2001, 21 years ago. Like, that's same guy. Like, just the same way they express themselves.
It's funny. I don't see that.
Joe's a little cockier. He wears the jewelry. Cockier. He's got the cigar. He won a national title at LSU.
First overall pick.
Brady was aw shucks.
He was. There was a lot of just,
he's,
you know.
He's fast-forwarded Brady, right?
Well, no. Yeah, I mean.
A couple years.
The Brady of then. The Brady of.
He's fast-forward Brady.
But as far as the transparency, back to our opening
segment. That isn't Brady.
The fact that he is like transparent, he's open with his emotions, he connects with his guys, he's real.
Yeah,
he's got a lot more flair, cigars, everything. He'll probably
diamonds and all that.
Probably like, wear a fur coat on the plane. I get all that. But as far as just the Athens, Ohio kid that just connects with people, and oh, by the way he throws it, and his fundamentals, and his arm, and his accuracy, and those things, once again, so similar.
Yeah.
To me. I said that to you a month ago.
Or similar to you or similar to Brady?
I wish me, but no.
more
similar to Tom.
Hey, did I tell you, by the way, that Hasselbeck brought up the whole artist or blacksmith thing the other day?
No.
He brought it all, and I just started laughing about how you were just like, well.
Yeah, I'm a blacksmith.
Sorry, coach, I'm a blacksmith.
That's what you got.
It's so funny.
Yes.
I'm jealous, I got to tell you. So you're telling me that like you want to watch Man in the Arena at your house, and everyone in your house gathers around to watch it together?
Including Isa Wrinkle.
Dude, wow. If I put the that on crew. In my house on the television in the main room, the amount of like eye rolling, disgust, like, Dad, is this something you have to watch for work that I would get? Like, I can't believe you just watch that with your family.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds delightful.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, I don't get any of that. Okay. Not in my life, I'll tell you that much. So, well, here we go. Bengals and Rams.
Do you think that has anything to do with the way you react watching to some of these games? Because I can only imagine you were a happy camper. If you're walking head down 3 days later to your parking lot, how are you in the basement watching Stafford win and the Bengals win? How's that going in the
house? I was delightful.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I was a delight to be around, Brock, as I'm sure you can imagine. And I'm sure the way I was talking and expressing myself is one of the reasons the kids are so excited to watch sports. Because yes. Who wouldn't want to have something drive you that level of insane?
Yes.
You know the scene in Die Hard where she sees Alan Rickman, or I'm sorry, she sees Carl Alexander Goodenough, and he's bashing the drink tray with his gun, and just destroying it.
No, none of us know that scene.
And she goes, John's alive. Only John could drive a man that crazy. Like, that's how I feel watching these games. I feel like Carl, just bashing whatever's around me. Yeah, it was rough. So, go Bengals, I guess, because that's preferable. The Rams.
Well, we'll talk about that next week. Yeah, we'll talk about that.
All right, we'll talk. We still have a week. What, you're going to root for the Rams? We got to talk about the Rams going all in, man. That's the other thing we got to talk about next week. Like, the Rams and their all-in approach. You want the Seahawks to give up every first-round pick?
Write that down, Howdy.
We're going to have a big conversation about that.
I bet we will, Howdy.
Really big.
All right, good. All right, well, then that's coming up next week. Maybe you can put me in the freaking open instead of Bruce Drennan by the time we get to next week.
By the way, I found the full Bruce Drennan rant.
It's so good.
Yeah.
It's one of my... You want to put a smile on my face? You play me some Bruce Drennan. I'll put a smile on my face in a hurry. All right, we got to run. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you, Brock. Oh, good as always. We will do it again next week leading up to the Super Bowl. Until then, the hay
is in the barn.
See everybody.
This is the chopper!